The Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe plug-in hybrid is built for the best of both worlds. For the city buzz, for the call of the wild, for finding solitude, for sharing memories, for day trips, and for far-roaming adventures. Because with gas and electric capability, the Jeep Grand Cherokee 4xe inspires you to explore more, to explore it all. Tap the banner to learn more. Jeep is a registered trademark of FCA US LLC.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Now John's with us.
Yeah, I'm now here.
Are you sure? Hello everyone, this is Colin Schindler, along with John Holmes and Patrick Barkley, welcoming you back to another edition of Football Ruin My Life. And joining us this week is the sports writer and former cricket correspondent of the Daily Telegraph, Michael Henderson, who is particularly welcome because he shares my opinion on this week's chosen topic, the decline of Corinthianism, or perhaps it's better referred to as sportsmanship. The very fact that I'm using such an archaic term as Corinthianism suggests that the concept is lost in the mists of antiquity. But to illustrate the concept, I refer all and sundry to two iconic, and I use that word advisedly, photographs. Bobby Moore and Pelé exchanging sweat-soaked shirts after their titanic struggle in Guadalajara in the 1970 World Cup group match, and the one of Andrew Flintoff crouching to comfort a devastated Brett Lee after England had beaten Australia by just 2 runs at Edgbaston in 2005. Those photographs suggest that perhaps good sportsmanship is not a thing of the past, but perhaps I'm more simply on an epic journey of nostalgia for the land of lost content where sportsmen behave with a certain nobility. Hendo, has that kind of behaviour exhibited by Moore and Pelé and by Lee and Flintoff mostly vanished from our sports fields?
Mostly, yes. Last year, when England played France in a World Cup match, Kane missed a penalty, and we saw shots of Mbappe celebrating, laughing. How on earth you can laugh when somebody misses a penalty, I don't know. But I would say this. We've seen the death of Bobby Charlton, who was a great footballer, but more than that, he was a great sportsman, and this was recognised not only in this country, but throughout the world. He represented something which we can't necessarily define absolutely. We can't quantify it, but we recognise it when we see it. Bobby Charlton was a great sportsman. Corinthian, yes, possibly. He had a natural dignity and a modesty. And because people responded to that in the way that they did, and so many people did, I think people still recognise and still appreciate that there is something more important than the winning and losing of matches.
John, do you share that feeling?
Yeah, I do. But having said that, I'm not sure it's changed quite as much as we would like to think in some ways because of the nostalgia. Because let's think back, you know, this expression, it's not cricket. Let's face it, W.G. Grace, in retrospect, was a complete cheat.
He was.
And Douglas Jardine, and the way he captained England and Australia in the Bodyline Series, they were not great examples of sportsmanship. So let's not get too nostalgic about the whole thing. I've seen plenty of examples of good behaviour now. I think one of the areas that has got certainly less sportsmanlike is amongst the crowd rather than amongst the players. Crowds now are far more confrontational. We've talked about the fact that before the days of television, when a great player came to play at your side, the Tom Finneys, the Billy Wrights, the Jimmy Greaves, people like that, we went to watch them and we applauded what they did. Now, the bit that really annoys me is opposition booing the best player of the opposition purely because they're good. I mean, that really is boneheaded.
Well, that's true in cricket too. Ricky Ponting was a classic example of a truly great batsman being booed as a pantomime.
This is what I'm saying. And this has come, hasn't it, again, all things from television. Mm. Television has been actually a fantastic thing for sport and for older people who can't get there. My father, during the last 5 years of his life, could never get to matches and things like that. For him, being able to watch Test cricket the whole time on the television, wonderful. Mm. And also for us, we can watch a lot of matches. We've seen a lot of players from around the world. We knew nothing of foreign players or foreign football before that time. But unfortunately, as with a lot of things, your greatest strength is also your greatest enemy. Yes, we all love to see examples of great sportsmanship, but let's not get too nostalgic about it.
We do see things in a sepia-tinted haze. I'm as guilty of that as anybody. I think what you say about television, John, is right. What it's encouraged is this cult, if you like, of the spectators, the witnesses, being participants in the drama. And when you have a goal scored now, the first thing we see is a shot of football supporters who are tribal at the best of time, waving their fists at the camera. There's this communal frenzy. But you're quite right, when an opposing player goes to take a corner, say, the abuse that these people have to endure. Mm. And it happens in football. It doesn't happen in other sports.
It happens in cricket. There is a lot of abuse.
I think of one day cricket,
players going to
true.
The yeah. oh in Test cricket as well. Michael,
is that right? Yeah. I haven't seen
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
Well, go back to 1970 yeah. and John Snow on the boundary.
Yeah.
Absolutely. That was a lone drunk. It was five o'clock in the afternoon.
If it was a lone drunk, it would have been very easy to remove him. Illingworth removed his side from the pitch because of the abuse that was going on.
Paddy, I want to ask you something, because I know you feel strongly about this. The idea of players going down, not hurt, or being kicked on the knee and rolling around holding their faces.
Yeah, this is tactical now. I mean, at last, the game's woken up to it. There are signs that people are trying to do something about it. The first thing, of course, was elongating the match. So you get 45 plus 11 and things like that. I mean, that is a typically cack-handed way of doing it. Personally, I think players should be treated for injuries on the field while the game continues. It may sound harsh, but I don't think there's any other way.
What happens then, Paddy, if the ball hits the attendant?
Well, it's like hitting the referee, isn't it?
Yeah,
It's like hitting the referee, the ball is dropped. It's a reasonable question, John, but there's always an excuse for not doing the right thing. It's not going to happen very often. I don't know if it's still the case, but when I used to be a rugby league fan, that was the case in rugby league, and there were no instances of that. Yeah, something's got to be done about that. It drives me absolutely crackers. And it is terrible sportsmanship, because what happens is so often players, being, in quotes, crafty, hold their heads, even if the only contact was with their ankle, because that's the only time when the referee has to stop.
But television finds that out, actually, does it not?
It does, and there's talk of sin binning for that, and I think it's a great idea. Teams, of course, will get round the sin bin as the same way as they get round everything. They'll practice 10v11s all week in training. You can play 10v11 for 10 minutes. Mm. It's very unlikely that anything untoward will happen, except that the game will get more boring.
But it does in rugby. When somebody gets sin binned for 10 minutes, frequently there is a try.
Yes. Frequently. Yes, that's true. But the game is slightly different.
Paddy, I listen with interest to what you say, but what I find inexcusable is that television pundits I was just going on to say this,
partly because, but not wholly, I'm not blaming ex-footballers, punditry, for this, because professional commentators who should know better say something about, well, he had to foul him there. No, he didn't. And there are lots of instances where a player takes a yellow card for the team.
It's not
for the team, it's weakening the team, because it means you can't do it again. But all these sort of clichés are coming in, and they're all cynical clichés. I mean, clichés are bad at any time, but clichés which espouse that sort of cynicism are completely wrong. And I do think the media, I mean, the way football is portrayed now, and I would include television on this, I mean, in terms of newspapers, often a great match is portrayed as a refereeing controversy. As far as television is concerned, pictures of players with their arms folded, smouldering at the camera. Mm. It's meant to sort of, you know, increase the adversarial
confrontation
side of the game. So in those circumstances, it's not surprising that we've bred a couple of generations of pillocks who think
it's perfectly natural.
It's perfect, yeah.
Yeah, but I can recall a few years ago, Chelsea were playing a European, well, it's now called a Champions League tie against Barcelona at Stamford Bridge. I was watching it in the pub, and I'd had to walk away because Drogba, the Chelsea number nine, kept falling over. Mm. Sometimes he was touched, usually he wasn't, but he kept going over as if he'd been caught by a sniper's bullet. Mm. And at half-time, one of the pundits, I shan't reveal his name, someone actually I quite like as a pundit. All right, I will. It's Martin Keown. Mm. He said that he was doing a good professional job for his team. Now, what he was doing was disrupting the match.
Before you go any further, Michael, one of your favourite players, and Collins as well, was someone we call Francis Lee. Francis Lee never went over, did he?
No, he went over.
Those golden halcyon years.
He went over frequently. Chaps. As I said, we do tend to see the past through, as Collins said, the happy highways where I went and cannot come again. We all do that in life, as in football. Franny Lee is my hero. Yes, he did dive. At least Lee went down. Usually there was some contact. But Drogba and others just fall over.
I think in fairness to Drogba, that was true of Drogba's early career.
Correct.
I think he cut that out of his game and became, instead of a very good centre-forward, a great one.
Drogba was a very
he was a very good player.
He became a much better player for not diving.
Yeah.
Yes, he was a very good player, Drogba. I don't doubt that. But the point I was making, Paddy, is whoever it was, Keown, I think, said he was doing a professional job.
Yeah,
it's cheating.
Yeah, that encourages them.
Paddy, this is the problem. There's a code of omerta within the professional game. Yes. Players, former players, do not criticise other players.
And neither do journalists.
Correct.
Journalists, in a lot of cases, and I'll take your profession to task on this, there were a lot of things going on in football in the 1970s and 80s regarding money and bungs and so on. And your profession steered well clear of it you were anxious to keep out
was a bloody disgrace when the bungs culture was rife.
With the exception of Brian Glanville.
Yes. Glanville's in a class.
Glanville called it in Italy. He didn't call it in this country.
You're absolutely right, John.
Yeah. Can I read out a letter that we've all had from one of our regular correspondents called David Fairholme, who is a Nottingham Forest supporter living in Scotland but watches all the matches. Mm-hmm. And he wrote to us a little while ago, just after City had beaten Forest 2-0 at home. He'd been to the game. And he wrote, "I really don't want to poison you all, but on Saturday, my, capital letters, player, Morgan Gibbs-White, collapsed as if he was hit by a train. Stupid Rodri of City for giving the ref and VAR the option to send him off for his hand raising. What was worse, another of my players gave Gibbs-White high fives or low fives for his theatrical performance. And a couple of weeks before, my favourite Forest player, Ryan Yates, one of our own, in inverted commas, gestured successfully for Foster of Burnley to be sent off. He had tickled Ryan in the ribs."
I think diving for a penalty, or diving when you're fouled, in other words, diving to draw the referee's attention to a foul, is the least of the sins of football. The point is, again, that's referee's fault. Because if you're slightly fouled and you stay on your feet, you never get the penalty.
No, that's absolutely right.
Absolutely never. So diving is entirely the creation of referees, not players, in my opinion. But what you're talking about is, to me, unprofessional. It's a little bit like the tactical time-wasting or breaking up of a counter-attack by pretending to be injured. Sooner or later, a referee is going to wave play on and the player will have concussion and might get a serious head injury. And it's that crying wolf aspect of it that I think makes it the lowest of the low.
Yeah, certain sides have got very adept at that now, and they've worked out this head concussion law and do go down And once they've been fouled, they then clutch their head because it breaks the attack up. Mm. And the referee, as you say, is bound to do that. This is where we get television. It has actually highlighted a lot. How many of Francis Lee's penalties would have been given penalty?
Well, if we'd had VAR referral.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sorry, I've got you two, really. I can see Henderson and Schindler are going to get up and punch me in a minute. But no, I think Rodney Marsh was another who was pretty good at that, wasn't he?
Oh, well, who did he go for?
I think there have been a few, John. Michael Owen went over fairly easily. Yeah. Raheem Sterling does today.
There was an occasion in the year that Leicester won the league.
Oh, did they win the league? Blessed year,
when Jamie Vardy was sent off by John Moss, formerly the drummer with Culture Club, and he sent Vardy off for simulating, as he said. Now, what happened was that Vardy was very adept at that because of his pace. Mm. What he did was he got beyond a player and then he would move towards the player so that the player running behind would automatically trip him.
Yeah.
Is that simulation? Is that being clever? Is that getting a reward for your speed? Mm. John Moss was later foolish enough to come to watch a game at Leicester. And I encountered him in the hospitality room beforehand and said to him, unless he paid me £500, I would have it announced that he was at the game and which seat he was sitting in. And interestingly, John Moss said to me that his mistake on that occasion was he earlier booked Vardy for something that he shouldn't have done, a really minor one. Mm-hmm. He still felt that what I've described was simulation. My view is that it was clever play.
Yeah.
No one said to you, you've got to run in a straight line. You can go that way.
Yeah.
And if that means that the player running behind you trips you up inadvertently or whatever it is that a foul? There wasn't VAR in that game. Moss actually later admitted that he also in that match gave a penalty to Leicester for a foul on Schlupp.
Mm.
I thought that was a fraction kind, let's put it like that. And he admitted that that was the only way, as he saw it, he was going to escape from the pitch.
He was crawling to you that day, wasn't he? Basically, yeah, but that's everything you said he agreed with.
Yeah, that's a habit that people should get into. Anyway, but it was very interesting how you saw that VAR, yeah, there are some bits that are wrong, but there are some bits that have got it right. I'm not... Like some people are saying that, well, you know, it's ruined the game and all this sort of stuff. I think some of the time lengths have, but I do think it's got right some things which were completely wrong.
Well, I'm dragging the conversation back to sportsmanship. Let me ask Hendo his memory of the 1980 FA Cup final, West Ham United.
That's right.
And the famous
Trevor Brooking scored.
And the yes,
Willie Young was sent off. Is that right?
Willie Young bringing down was it Paul Allen?
Yeah.
In the most horrible, you know,
17-year-old Paul Allen. Yeah,
this was widely castigated in your profession, Paddy, wasn't it? As well,
yes,
professional. That this was a terribly unprofessional foul.
Yes.
So there's a slight sense of inconsistency.
Didn't it happen in the cup final in 1985? Everton,
yes, it
Manchester
did.
United?
Well, it was the first ever sent.
Well, that was Moran being sent
sending off.
Was Kevin Moran sent off?
Sent off for a foul on Peter Reid.
Yeah, well, Peter Reid deserves everything he was getting.
Did Everton win? No, United won.
United won.
Whiteside.
Norman Whiteside curled it round Neville Southall's dive. Yeah.
But it's the sportsmanship element. That's an interesting comparison between Peter Reid being fouled and Paul Allen being fouled. Paul Allen being 17 years old, the youngest player on the field.
Yeah, that was a factor.
Somehow to sort of bring him down was kind of an offence against God,
whereas
Peter Reid was an offence against law. If you see what I mean, there's a difference between the two.
Yes.
And so what I'm asking about is whether that kind of unprofessional fouling goes way back, not just beyond VAR, but
who was
into
it?
The history of football.
Who was the hacker, Paddy, the well-known hacker? Lord Kinnaird. Someone said, if you don't mind your ways, my lord, you'll come back with a broken leg. And his wife said, well, it won't be his.
That was Norman Hunter. That is apocryphal.
There's always been filthy play. What staggers me now is the appalling quality of tackling.
Yeah.
There was always filthy play, and there was robust play as well, and I think you have to make the distinction. I was always annoyed when I heard Stuart Pearce, a footballer who I thought was outstanding, called psycho. There was nothing psychotic about Pearce. No. He was a clean and manly player who went for the ball, sometimes caught the man. The, quote, professional fouls have always existed, I think. I think we shouldn't get too misty-eyed about that.
There's a moment where Paolo Di Canio caught the ball. Somebody had gone down injured. Instead of scoring, he caught the ball.
That was at Goodison Park, and I think he was playing for West Ham, was he? And a corner came over, and he had what we probably wrote as the goal at his mercy. And he, instead of shooting, because the goalkeeper, was it Paul Gerrard or somebody, was stricken, and instead of shooting, he picked the ball up and said, quick, get someone on to... And he won the FIFA Fair Play Award. I credit FIFA for this, their Fair Play Award. I can remember, I hate praising Dundee United, but when they lost one of the European finals to IFK Gothenburg on their home ground in the second leg, the entire crowd stayed to give the IFK Gothenburg players a lap of honour and threw their tangerine scarves, and the IFK Gothenburg players kept them. And it was a beautiful sight, and that won the FIFA Fair Play Award. So I think that's a good thing. I think also... I hated at first this business of all the players shaking hands before a match. That was started, I think, by UEFA rather than FIFA. I can't remember. Maybe it was FIFA. But somehow that has been of benefit because fans have seen players, chums, maybe two guys both from Sierra Leone, bump fists, but they're different sides. At least it's given the impression that football is not played between people who really hate each other. They're just earning a living. Now, that looks good to me. I like
I don't like that. Not shaking of hands because they don't. They just slap each other's wrists. Just get on with the game. I preferred it, to be honest. I am old-fashioned. I liked it when teams emerged separately.
So did I.
It was part of the ritual of the Saturday
afternoon. Was cheering
your
team coming out. Yes. Whereas the two teams come out together, you're almost cheering like a double scarf.
That was reserved for the FA Cup final.
Yeah, yeah.
Double scarves.
You know, the double scarves.
An abomination.
I think if you see someone with one, you should be legally allowed to strangle them.
What I find particularly revolting about football, I think we all do to a lesser or greater degree, the appalling bullying of referees.
Yeah.
Now, this really goes to the heart of the matter of sportsmanship. And then, of course, the bleating afterwards by the managers. Mm. It was a penalty. It was never a penalty. It was offside. It was onside. Why can't they just accept these things? These things happen in the course of a season and get on with it. I admired Brian Clough for that. He wouldn't criticise.
Clough was definitely in advance on that. One of the problems is now, and this comes back again to television, the fact is that managers have to go on the media after the game.
Mm.
Their microphone is shoved under their face. They've got to say something. They're still emotional about it. And I'm afraid they sometimes say silly things. Sometimes I'm amazed, actually, by the restraint in which they do exercise.
You're good.
I think the obsession of the media in terms of what you, the scribblers, called nannies, quotes, nanny goats, is ridiculous. I think, actually, you should tell the game as you see it rather than as the managers or the players see it.
He's very bitter about it. He calls us scribblers and he's having a go.
No, I think he's...
Because instead of pursuing a career in journalism, which he could have done, he became a multimillionaire instead.
I think John makes a good point. As we know, there are many journalists for whom the game is merely a MacGuffin. Their work begins at 5 o'clock because they've got a back page to fill and managers are forever roaring defiantly. I've never yet heard a manager roar defiantly. But they do once a week in some papers. There's something Howard Wilkinson said, picking up on John's point. He said, half an hour after a game ends on a Saturday, and I've been preparing for this all week, we all have, I'm asked questions which, if I were to answer them honestly, I would need all weekend to think about. And that is the problem.
Absolutely.
If I were a manager, again, like Clough, in the end, he didn't talk to people at all. It's very difficult at 5:30, having to speak sensibly and logically about something when the beans are jumping, as Nasser Hussain likes to say. But I still think that managers should think twice and then twice again before they hide behind the imperfections of referees. Bill Nicholson told his Tottenham players, every one of you will make more mistakes this afternoon than the man with the whistle.
Yeah.
And that's worth remembering, I guess.
Here's a confession, and I don't know if anybody else does the same thing. As a TV viewer, here's the mea culpa. Say if Man United, when Ferguson was the manager, got beaten, I would want him on the telly as soon as possible because I want to see him crying.
Yeah.
I want to see him humbled. Am I wrong? Am I being human or am I being a particularly nasty piece of work?
You're being human, but what of course means is that the greatest strength of television is what it reveals and we could see more. The greatest weakness is that actually it goes to some places that really probably are best left alone. But that's the nature of it, I'm afraid. The point you make, Michael, very well about Harold Wilkinson, who was one of the more thoughtful managers, is absolutely correct. Because football is an emotional game. That's why we love it. The drama of it and all that sort of thing. And in the moments after the game, we do get emotional about it and we say things that we should not say.
Yeah.
But as you think about it later and go over it in your mind, because we're obsessives and we do this about the game, we think then in retrospect, that's right. And of course, sometimes we watch a video replay now of things that have gone on and go, I was wrong there.
Even in an ideal world, there is a legitimate reason for manager, and in particular referee interviews after the match, and that's to clear things up. Now, 20 minutes from the end of an England doubleheader, Harry Kane is substituted. Now, the obvious question is, was he injured? Because, obviously, that would have a bearing on whether he'd be fit for the next game. So that's a legitimate purpose. The trouble is, you can't stop journalists having different agendas. Some would ask the sensible footballing question about Harry Kane. Others would say, but what about the sending off, you know, and, oh, God, he could cost me my job. You know, that kind of routine. You've got to have some way of checking things. And in my opinion, it contributes to the tendency of the media to highlight refereeing mistakes. You can't find out the reason. You can't have one journalist who goes into the referee's room after the game and said, why on earth did you send him off? And the referee says, because we had a guidance at the beginning of the season that if a guy spits, we've got to send him off. So that would sort of lance that particular boil.
But I come back to the bullying of referees, irrespective of what managers say after the match. They're responsible for the conduct of their players in the 90 plus 8 minutes. And it's inexcusable. And it doesn't happen in other sports. Could you imagine if you talk back to the referee in rugby, you'd be reviled by your own teammates?
You can hear what happens, actually, because certainly during Six Nations or Rugby World Cup matches, you can hear the referees saying to an 18-stone, muscle-bound man, I heard that. Yeah. If I hear it again, you're not going to be taking part in this game.
Hold on. We're not going to go, oh, this rugby, they're dreadfully good chaps. And all
I don't think
they
are.
They go bite each other's ears off. I don't find that terribly good.
No, but we were specifically talking about respect for referees.
They have a respect for the referee, not because they like them.
Not always.
They have respect for them.
Some have been done for actually quite aggressively dealing with referees.
Well, Owen Farrell thinks he is a referee.
Yes, I think he's an exception.
Yeah, he is an exception.
They have a respect for the office of the referee, even if they don't particularly like them. They call them sir. This happens in league as well as union.
Of course,
rugby is a game based on violence. It is. There's no getting away from that.
Yeah.
But the players themselves police themselves rather well. And furthermore, when they do punch each other, and they do, usually they stay on their feet. They don't fall over like footballers who don't even feel the punch at all.
But we talk about respect for referees. Last season, or I can't remember when it was, you must have seen Mitrovic actually lay hands on a referee at Old Trafford. And Fulham, to their, and I'm a season ticket holder at Fulham, to their eternal discredit, they sanctioned a statement from Mitrovic afterwards saying, I'm sorry I was sent off. No apology to the referee, but I'm sorry for being sent off. And I fully deserve the three-match punishment that will come my way. Oh, yeah, he got, I think, seven, but it should have been 17.
They should have won that game, of course. They went to pieces.
They were leading and then they fell apart.
It was a cup tie, wasn't it? They were a goal up and they fell apart.
We were slightly handicapped by the fact that our own manager, who was, should have been the one bollocking Mitrovic, had already been sent to the stands for over-protesting. But that should have been the signal. And I know we were going to lose our top goal scorer a bit early, although he did get transferred in the next window. But he should have been banned for such an exemplary length of time that nobody would ever think of.
Well, that should happen to anyone who puts hands on a referee.
The one thing you can't do.
Can you get when he pushed Paul Alcock? 8 matches, was it?
Something. Yeah, I don't know. Eight matches, but to be fair, that was... Alcock should have been booked for going down too easily. Yeah.
Which footballers do we think, all of us, represent the best aspects?
Gianfranco Zola.
Yeah.
Bobby Charlton was what you mentioned.
Trevor Brooking, perhaps?
Yes, yeah. Trevor Brooking.
Bobby Moore,
sir.
Tom Finney, I'm going back before time, of course. But
current players. Current players. I mean, I thought Southgate is exemplary as a football man, both as a player and a manager.
Listen, we forget a lot of the time that sportsmen are young men.
Yeah.
They are playing in the spotlight.
Yeah.
They are playing under pressure, whether we like it or not. There are large amounts of money involved.
Yeah.
Journos have taken money for articles that they know they shouldn't have written.
No.
And so on. We, all of us, have done things during our life.
Yeah.
Have we been subjected to the pressure that sportsmen are subjected to, we would have done the wrong thing.
Well, the perfect example of this was Zinedine Zidane. But for one split second, if you'd said to me, name a footballer who's great and sums up sportsmanship, when you said Bobby Charlton, Hendo, I would have counted with Zinedine Zidane.
Yes.
But of course, he's remembered as much for the left foot volley at Hampden Park as for putting the nut on Marco Materazzi. Yes. That said, I think the law should have been amended, which said sticking the nut on an opponent is a red card unless it's Marco Materazzi.
You cannot underrate the pressure that some of these people are put under. And yes, there will be occasions when people do the right thing and people do the wrong thing. Mm. Talk about rugby. Steve Smith, the England rugby scrum half, playing for England, very late in the game, gave a really bad pass to the opposition who went over and scored a try. He was lying on the ground, distraught, and the television highlighted Bill Bowman, who was the captain, ran over and picked him up. Now, Steve Smith, now this may have been apocryphal, in his after-dinner speech said, actually, what Bill Bowman said to him was, you cunt.
Yeah. Sportsmanship in a situation like that, there are two things that stick out for me. In the not too recent past, we lost Terry Venables. And I remember at the end of Euro 96, when he, as well as the entire English football nation, thought that England could win a trophy on home soil, and they just fell short in that semi-final because of a penalty.
And the length of Paul Gascoigne and studs.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Gareth Southgate had missed the penalty. And at the final whistle, Venables, who must have been thinking, I'm not going to be Sir Terence Venables. Mm. My career has missed out on its natural climax. He didn't think about that. He ran straight across the pitch to Southgate. And there's a wonderful picture of Venables hauling Southgate to his feet, putting his hands on his cheeks. Venables had a great big cheeky, you know, Venable-esque smile on his face. And he was saying, come on, Gareth, chin up. Nobody's going to blame you. He was doing his best to cheer him up. So his thoughts were only for his player and not for himself. And another one, perhaps even more impressive, in Moscow after the Champions League final between Manchester United and Chelsea, which was decided when John Terry slipped on a very tricky pitch. Yeah. And it hit the post on the way. Mm-hmm. And finally at the end, I don't know who hit the winning penalty, I can't remember now. But at the end, Terry, his Chelsea having lost, was lying on the pitch utterly distraught and the rain was still teeming down. And Gary Neville, who wasn't playing that night.
Was he not?
Because he was wearing a suit. And his suit was already soaking and he ran across the pitch and consoled Terry.
Well, that's like Liam Flintoff, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's thinking about somebody other than yourself.
Exactly. Those are things that I remember, along with the Di Canio thing. And that's sportsmanship.
You go back as well to that wonderful picture, and now we know what he said. Alf Ramsey telling Harold Shepperson to sit down when the World Cup. In the same tournament, of course, Alf had gone on the pitch and stopped George Cohen exchanging shirts with the Argentinian.
The animals.
The animals, and he called them animals and all the rest of it.
Well, these are talking about managers after the game, And making that point, it was so rare for Alf to do that. That's what made it so interesting.
Some managers are good at staying unemotional. Other managers, and we've had one on this podcast, Martin O'Neill used to go potty during the game.
Yes.
Martin O'Neill's great, adopted many, many things of Brian Clough. He would make a fuss of somebody, which Clough used to do, make you feel as though you were the person that he most wanted to meet that day, which was complete rubbish. It was just because he wanted something out of you. Martin used to do that as well. But Martin used to jump about on the side of the pitch like mad, whereas Cloughy didn't do that.
No.
Until later on, of course, he ran on the pitch and hit the...
That was at the end of the game, John, yeah.
Yeah, but Clough was drunk.
He was drunk. He'd taken the drink. I was there.
Different people behave in different ways. The game is a game of high emotion. It's the high emotion we love. I can remember taking my son when he was very young to that famous game between Leicester and Arsenal when Bergkamp got the hat-trick. I think there were three goals scored in what was then an exceptional amount of overtime.
Yeah.
Leicester had come back from being 2-0 down, scored two in the last 10 minutes to get back on level terms. Then Bergkamp scored a wonderful goal where he controlled it, overhead and put it in. And watching my son's emotions going up and down. And then Steve Walsh, who was an all-time hero at Leicester, an extraordinary sort of boy's own type of character who played at centre-half but scored important goals and so on. Equalised with a stunning header in the in the umpteenth minute. And to watch my son's emotions going up and down like that, and the emotions of everyone around, grown-up people and so on, and with us that day in the crowd was a man called Bill Bateson, well-known to Paddy Barker, who was a massive Arsenal fan, putting his arm round my son and saying, that's football, that's what makes it.
Yeah.
And, of course, we would all talk absolute rubbish. Some of us managed to stay reasonably calm, either because of position of parental responsibility or whatever else, and some of us let it go. But if the game is not emotional, if the game does not get you into a state where actually you say and talk rubbish, then it's possibly died a bit. I mean, I do talk rubbish on occasions at football. Any supporter, if they're honest, will know that Colin talks complete rubbish on occasions.
No, no, most all the time.
All right.
You mentioned Clough, and Brian Clough was a remarkable figure in many ways. And one of the reasons he despised Leeds United, it was for the best of reasons, because he felt they subverted the game. He had an ideal of how football could be played, part of the reason
Brian
that...
Brian Clough had a streak of idealism.
He was an idealist. Yes, he did plenty of other things, but he never sent out teams to kick or to maim. I happen to believe his best team was at Derby County, who won the championship in 72, and I happen to believe that if he'd stayed at Derby County instead of flouncing out in October 73... they would have dominated English football as Liverpool did in the following decade, because he would have signed Peter Shilton, who he always wanted, John knows that.
Yes.
But he despised Leeds United because he used to say to journalists, do they not know how good they are? Because if they ever find out, the rest of us won't win a pot between us. But they subverted the game and they cheated. They cheated themselves and they cheated the game.
As ever, these people... And Clough, more than anything else, Clough was completely homophobic over Fashanu, disgracefully homophobic. And the way he treated Fashanu was utterly shocking and may have ultimately led to his suicide.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's all good or all bad.
No.
Clough did represent some great things in football, but he was also one of those people who got involved in bungs more than anybody else.
John, I hear what you say, and that's absolutely right. But as a manager, as a football manager, he did have an almost naive belief that the game could and perhaps should be played in a certain way. He certainly wasn't a paragon of human virtue, far from it. But his teams never cheated. He may have done off the field, but his teams never cheated.
And he did believe very strongly about this cheating.
That's true.
But there is that speech that Michael Sheen delivers as Clough in the Damned United. You know, you can take all your cups and all your pots and all your pans and you can throw them in the bin because you've won them all by bloody cheating.
Yeah, I think he was wrong to say that, though.
I think he was wrong to say
that. It was bad management, wasn't it?
Yeah, you don't tell John Giles and Billy Bremner and Paul Madeley. It was Madeley who did for him in the end, actually. Mm-hmm. Madeley, the honest man who never said anything.
No.
When Manny Cussins said, "What do you think, Paul?" He said, "He's a bad un." Well, he wasn't, of course, but he was quite wrong to go in and tell those players, "You've cheated." You may think that, you don't say it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they didn't need to. That was the whole point. Well, that was such a good start.
This is the thing. In Revy's last season, 73-4, for the first time, he took the brakes off. Mm. They won the championship before Christmas. That was a formidable...
29 games unbeaten.
Formidable team. And I still think, if I were asked, what is the best English club side you've seen? Well, I saw Manchester United in 66. Yes. That was pretty good. Three great players in the team.
Yes, yes.
And there have been very good teams at Liverpool, obviously, and Manchester United. And Arsenal, I would say the Arsenal team, the people who went for a year or year. That was a magnificent team, possibly the best to watch. But the most formidable was Leeds United in 74. I think they were physically imposing and they could all play.
They could all play and did play.
And was that the season where they had the 7-0 against Southampton?
No, I don't think it was.
It was a little earlier.
Is that sportsmanship or is it not? Is the almost taunting of Southampton?
No, I thought it was showboating.
No, I don't think it was. I think it verged on it. I know, and you would have to put Lorne Baxter in 1967, you know, sitting on the ball and all that kind of stuff. Dennis Law and Jim Baxter both took the piss, but particularly Jim Baxter, as you would imagine, against what was a 10-man England, who were the world champions, and nobody quite understood why we didn't try and score 9 to level up the scores. But if you're Scottish, you know taking the piss was much more important than scoring any more goals. But that was showboating, but I could never find it in my heart to criticise that. Nor would I criticise Leeds for showboating in that game against Southampton, because Southampton were dirty bastards in those days. They were a hard...
And Leeds weren't, were they?
Well, Leeds were saying there, yeah, we can match you physically...
But we can also play.
But we can also play, and that's the difference. And I think they were allowed to do this.
This sitting on the ball, Keith Weller, who was one of the best players I've ever seen, he was want to do that sitting down trick on occasions. Showing off with skill, generally wingers, more than anybody else. They're sometimes inclined to take the mick, which is... One of the reasons why I rate John Robertson probably as one of the greatest wingers I've ever seen, because he never felt the need.
No, he never wasted a movement.
No. When he got a chance to cross, he crossed it.
I mean, the antithesis of that would be Ginola.
Yes.
By the time his cross came over, the centre forward was triple marked.
That's right. I don't like showboating. And I take your point, actually, Paddy. But to me, there has to be a purpose, which is why the greatest goal ever scored was scored by Carlos Alberto in the 1970 final, because it involved everybody and it ended with a magnificent goal.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember Jim Lawton telling me, he used to ghost John Giles's column for the Express, and Giles said, and this really should never be forgotten, he said, everybody in the game and without the game knows that Pelé is the greatest footballer there ever was or ever will be. The reason for that is not just that he's a virtuoso. It's because everything he does is for the benefit of the team. Mm. And that's absolutely right. Yeah. Pelé was the greatest player. There can be no argument about that unless you think Alfredo Di Stefano is. Matt Busby apparently thought he was the greatest player he ever saw.
Yes.
But Pelé was cities and streets above everybody else, partly because he put the team first.
I would just like to say that I think Maradona was a team player as well.
Yes, he was. Yes, he clearly
And Messi.
Was.
Whatever yes, they we were. Say about yes. Messi, he was a team player.
So was George Best.
What? All
George Best was a team player.
Sure.
Zinedine Zidane was. Johan Cruyff.
Johan Cruyff was the man who, it was fine as long as they did what he said.
I'd be happy to take his advice. <Yeah. to>
One of the
and
interesting
luckily,
bits
Pep
about
Guardiola
that
was too.
Is, of course, Johnny Rept, who was a very good player
was
in that Dutch side, scored a lot of the goals. He's well known for saying that actually Cruyff was a complete pain in the arse.
I'm sure he was, but he was the greatest footballer I ever
That's
saw in the flesh.
Opinion shared by Gary Lineker, incidentally.
Cruyff changed the game, and To me, he is an ideal. I've never seen a footballer who represents the ideal of what I want from a footballer, just as Garfield Sobers was my ideal cricketer, and Ballesteros, who was slightly different. He was a romantic virtuoso, but what a man.
I don't want to make John Holmes blush on behalf of his client.
You can't.
Not on a podcast.
I have no shame.
But we talked earlier about players who are good examples of sportsmanship. I think Lineker and his former Leicester colleague Alan Smith would be two that come to mind. As you know, I mentioned Gianfranco Zola earlier, and I think he's the most likeable footballer that's ever played in the Premier League. I'm not saying the best, although he would be in that envelope, but he's the most likeable player. I doubt if he was ever booed on an away ground.
No, I think that's probably right. Let me tell you a little story about Alan Smith, who I think was booked once.
I was going to say, was he ever booked?
He was booked once, Alan. And it's one of Gary's favourite stories that obviously they played very well together. And in one particular game, the referee, whoever it was, I think Alan had got involved with something or tripped up or something. And the referee came over as if to book him. And Smithy, who's not a daft fellow, but of course, then his Birmingham accent was probably more pronounced then, looked at the referee and said, "Oh, ref, you can't book me. I've never been booked, you know. Honestly, oh, no. sorry, honestly." And the other players were, of course, completely creased up. I think it was Roger Milford, the referee, if you remember, had slightly long hair.
He was a bit of a showman.
Princess Diana. I think in one of Gary's last games in England, he was refereeing and went as if to book Gary as a bit of a joke. And Gary actually realised what was going on. Smart ass. But It was very funny. You know, people sometimes say there's no characters in the game and so on. There are characters in the game. You know, I'm lucky enough to be friends with a guy called Alan Birchinall. One of the iconic pictures of Birch's career was of him kissing Tony Curry. One of those spontaneous moments in football, which led to all sorts of fallout, and Birch got letters from Stonewall Group and all sorts of things. And it was just completely spontaneous and very lovely.
And well done the photographer for snapping it.
Well done for the photographer for getting it. I don't know, is that sportsmanship, is that humour?
There are bits
of football. We've got two people who've fallen out of love recently with football.
Yeah.
Now, there are aspects of the modern game I really don't like, but I tell you what, I still pretty much look forward to going to games. There are still great moments in the game that make me smile, and I've been privileged to watch all sorts of players and see things at close range, and I've got to know a lot of players over the years. Football gives the greatest pleasure to a lot of people. Yes, sportsmanship may have gone down a bit, but the people who give us such entertainment, I don't begrudge them the money they make now. You know what?
Especially if you're getting 15% of it.
I would rather they got the money than a lot of the people who'd hang around.
But it's a binary choice.
Correct. You know, we have to accept that the reason people listen to this podcast as well is that we do love the game. We love the game maybe a bit more when we were younger, but we loved a lot of things more when we got younger. So let's appreciate the game for what it is, which is, I think, the greatest game in the world.
Well, I can't think of a better way to... You've done my job for me, because that's the perfect summing up. Thank you, John.
Do I get paid double?
You get paid while I get paid. One threatening bit. So thank you to John for that summing up and other things, and thank you to Paddy as ever, and thank you to Michael Henderson for being another guest who has contributed mightily to the success of the show. I also think that the reason I chose this topic particularly is because, well, partly because of that letter from David Fairhope, but because I think it chimes with what our audience thinks. We're always keen to know what our audience thinks, because it informs our behaviour and it's terribly helpful. Please continue to do so. And the address, as you know, is footballruinedmylife, allone word@gmail.com. And so on behalf of Michael, and on behalf of Paddy, and on behalf of John, this is Colin Shinter saying thank you all for listening. See you all next time on Football Ruined My Life.